Okay, having a little bit of trepidation here. Been thinking about this for the whole sit.
Planning.
I'm gonna tell you why I have trepidation. I want to read a poem. Want to read a poem to start us out to talk about what I think the Dhamma does for social engagement. And I think this poem is exactly what the Dhamma does. It's written by Maya Angelou. The trepidation, though, is that I think it's only me and Nana that are the black people on this call. So I have to qualify this a little bit here because we have it etched in our brains that black people were the slaves, white people were not. And that is just such a etched, chiseled into our minds that if we hear something about slavery or about black people, I fear that white people will think, oh, that's about them. That's not about me. But I want you to hear this poem about you. It may be that we're using the black experience as a way to articulate something, but this is not a black poem, and it's not about black people. It's about, I think, the difficulty that we have with social engagement in life. So I thought a way to read this poem would be, since we're all practitioners, to think of Myra. What is it? Maya. Mara. That's who it is. Mara. Think of Mara in relation to you. So you, in this poem, there is a you that is pointed to. You are doing this, you are doing that, you are doing that. That you is Mara to us as practitioners. And we are enslaved in that thing that Lauren was pointing to with Mara. So I want to qualify that so that you do not hear this poem as a poem about black people, and you hear this poem about you in your relationship with the Dhamma. I don't, you may have already heard the poem before. It's called Still I Rise, but it's the best. This is what I believe the Buddha's pointing was to regular people. And even what Lauren was pointing to with the pool that Ajahn Chah was pointing to. So I'm going to have us close our eyes so you don't look at me and see a black woman, because that's just going to mess everything up. Boy, oh, see, Kaya, is he black too? Okay, so close your eyes so we can see inside ourselves, and who the you is in this poem is Mara, and how Mara imposes itself on our lives and enslaves us to certain the unwholesomeness of greed, hatred, and delusion. That's the way I'd like you to hear this poem. So, take a moment here. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Because I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns with the certainty of tides, just like hopes springing high, still, I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? Does my hauntedness offend you? Don't you take it awfully hard? 'Cause I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness. But still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meetings of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling. I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise into a daybreak that's wondrously clear. I rise, bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, I rise, I rise. That is what I think Dhamma is. I think Dhamma is not, it is a sword against Mara and the heaviness that Mara brings us. And much of what we see in social engagement and social injustice is Mara and the pain of that and the weight of that and the hatred of that. So I thought I would talk a little bit, if we're all in this place that says Dhamma is the hope that allows us to rise above and beyond whatever the negativity is that Mara seeps within our lives, pushing and poking and showing us over and over and over, then we could use the resilience of Black people as an example of what is possible with Dhamma in this world that seems so against the Dhamma. That's the difficulty. We get overwhelmed by it, and it seems against the Dhamma, but it's not. It's actually in the midst of this that Dhamma actually is supposed to work. So a way to think about this, that thought, I want to give you a quote, something that Thich Nhat Hanh said. I think he's the one that coined this idea that we would do social justice, this idea of engaged Buddhism. I think he's the one that coined that. Because he believed, he was living as a young monk in a world that was beset with the war from the Vietnam War. And he believed that Buddhism, that all Buddhism was engaged. By its very nature, it is engaged because it applies to all aspects of life. And he emphasized that he wanted the monks to be a bridge from what was needed by the monastic and lay communities so that Buddhism itself could be this kind of a response to difficulties and anguish in the world. So he took the idea that mindfulness and loving kindness together would be the thing that could help Vietnamese people and all peoples in the world survive a very, very treacherous time. I mean, it got worse and worse and worse, and many of the monks did not follow his understanding, and so that's why he created a new order. And eventually he had to leave because it was getting so dangerous for him politically. And so he then left And instead of keeping his understanding of Buddhism as an engaged practice in and of itself, he took that out of Vietnam and taught it all over the world. I think that's why he was so close to so many civil rights activists, is because his understanding of Dhamma in relation to world crises spoke to many, many, many activists. So what I think, if I were to say what I thought about engaged Buddhism, what he's talking about is the basic difficulty we have. So you start with this, making sure that you have the right view. Right view in Dhamma means that we are not trying to fix anything. We're not trying to fix a problem. We are trying to see things as they are. We don't want to compare who's right, who's wrong. It's more like seeing harm itself and responding to the harm, wherever that harm may be and however it's showing up. I think one of the moments in all the George Floyd's protests, one of the moments that really sticks with me a long time is a moment when a white guy, he was actually on the right in a counter protest. I don't know if you guys remember this. You may do, but he somehow got separated from his big crew of people that were, you know, pushing up against the Black Lives Matter movement, and he kind of got separated from his group, and he got in this really, really dangerous situation where people were trying to beat him up, and this black guy picked him up in the midst of all that and carried him out. And to me, that is this idea that it's not about maybe the politics. He probably didn't agree with the politics of this guy, but in the midst of harm, you respond to that. And that's what I think Dhamma points to, is harm versus not harm, rather than right versus wrong, or who's good, who's bad. And then lastly, the right view we talked about last week was this inevitability of human suffering, that we live in a world of greed, hatred, and delusion as our underlying tendencies. So every one of us and all beings, we live in a world where unless we specifically apply the practice to disrupt, dislodge, unhook ourselves from greed, hatred, and delusion, we will inevitably cause harm to another out of that greed, hatred, and delusion, whether we want to or not. And the more we get trapped in it, the more harm we can cause. And the practice is designed to get us out. So how I see this practice applying to our this larger world context is that we are holding the universal reality of this altruistic, may all beings be happy, may all beings be supported, may all beings be free. That's what we're holding. And we believe that. That is not just some kind of like Pollyanna, kumbaya, oh, can we all just get along kind of energy. It is, we believe it, that world is possible. And at the same time, we live in a relative reality where greed, hatred, and delusion runs amok. And Mara gets their way constantly, creating havoc everywhere. So as practitioners, what I think are, I guess you could say, guidepost, the middle way, is to live within those two dichotomies, to live in the middle of it, to not get so far over here that we just live in the altruistic and we don't want to deal with the relative, or not get so far over in the relative that we lose the belief in the altruistic possibility that greed, hatred, and delusion can be uprooted, and we can live in a world where there is happiness for all beings. And this is what I think our practice is all designed to do, is to help us live in that. So, a couple more things. the Brahmaviharas is how we hold that, because the Brahmaviharas build capacity to be kind in a world that seems like there's no kindness. To see it, I see kindness all over the place. Constantly, I see it because I am acutely aware of the existence of kindness. And so because of that, I just see it all the time, everywhere I go. And being able to live in a world that has a lot of cruelty and see kindness all the time is the middle way that I do not get overwhelmed by the cruelty I see at the same time. It is, we need this kindness is the way that we're able to be up close with the relative reality. So we can't get up close to suffering if we don't have enough softened kindness to be able to approach it. It's too hard, it's too harsh, and it's too painful. But compassion is that kindness that allows us to get close to suffering. Mudita is the joy that uplifts us, which is what I think Maya Angelou was pointing to. That even though there's so much heaviness, there's this notion that I am forever going to rise up in that joy. Forever. I don't care what it is. I'm rising up in it. And the equanimity of the balance to hold both our altruistic kind of ultimate realities that we believe to be true. Here and now, not someday it's going to be. Here and now, all beings are free. And the relative reality here and now that all beings are subject to greed, hatred, and delusion. So I think the Brahmaviharas is what gives us the capacity to do this. We cultivate that so we can be able to go further. And then there's the Four Noble Truths. It's like the map. It's our map. It's what keeps us in the middle way. And we hold this truth that suffering is inevitable. At the same time, there is a cause of dukkha that I am causing in this moment in time. And that if I unbound myself from that greed, hatred, and delusion, that's what clinging is. It's either clinging to wanting something that you want and it's not here, or clinging to not wanting something you don't want, but it is here and you don't want it, but you have to suck it up. This is what the world is offering you in this moment. So that clinging is the push-pull of greed, hatred, and delusion. And the delusion is our ignorance. We don't see that the reason why I'm having so much suffering is because of that pushing and pulling and trying not to be in the world as it is. I think of the Eightfold Path, you know, it's just basically our guidance. But the three characteristics is the, you could think of it as a compass, you know, because you can have a map, but you won't stay on that map. Unless you have something that kind of helps you know you're going north. If you're trying to get to Everett from Seattle, you kind of got to know where north is. And you got to know that even though it's a beautiful drive, if you go south, you're not really going to get to Everett going that way. It's right, quite beautiful. I think the more beautiful drive is south than north. But you're not getting to Everett if you drive south. And so it's seeing that, beginning to understand, and I think the three characteristics are about that. They are the compass that help us see our way. They do that by constantly reminding us that dukkha is inevitable, that the world is impermanent and it's changing and it's not about us. So we can see the distortions of mind. And then lastly, I think the rest of the, I mean, there's so many lists, hindrances and whatnot. The rest of that, these lists actually help us begin to have an interest in the path, an interest in the moment. So all these various lists that show up of the hindrances and the faculties and dependent origination and all of it kind of give us something to work with as we're moving down this path in any situation. So I want to give us time to talk about this. And so let me just kind of end here with this. The thing that I'm pointing to is to expect that we will not have societal pain, that we will not have, that we will not suffer through dark times in history, which, you know, I think I told you guys last week, I think we're in the dark ages. I just think we need to come to terms with that and recognize we are not in the Renaissance. We are in the dark ages. And that means we're dark times, difficulty and pain. It's sort of the practice is about us being able to recognize where we are in our existence and not try to somehow be in a better world. We don't need to be in a better world. We need to be in this world. This is where we're supposed to be. This is why we're living right now. It's because we're supposed to practice with this as it is. And if your connection to the world has got you so heavy, so the sense of downtroddenness, you got to move over into the altruistic and hold a little bit of that to lift you up some. So that you have a sense that, oh, it's not always like this. And I do what I can and I make a difference in the world. And I trust that all of us as practitioners are all going to do what we can and we make a difference in the world. And we're going to move towards the Renaissance. I think if we're too over in that altruistic world and you really just don't want to look at the pain that's going on around us, then I think we got to move a little bit closer to suffering. You got to move into some of that suffering you're experiencing so that you can begin to be with the suffering without being overwhelmed. And the more you lean over into the altruistic side, the more overwhelming life looks to us. The more we lean over into the life is this, it's this, it's this, the more we lose our connection to this altruistic kind of all beings need to be free. So what I want us to approach with during the time of questions is to begin to ask, where are you on this gauge? Are you more over in the altruistic and very afraid of the get, you know, stuck in the pain, overwhelmed by the pain of the world? Or are you so over in the pain of the world that you think that whole, you know, all beings be free that we say at the end and sending merit and metta, it's just like a fake thing that we do, but Buddhism is way too soft for actually changing or freeing the world, not changing, but freeing the world. So where are you on this pendulum? And just see. And as you begin to sense into where you are, you can also sense into where do I need to move. I see Achilles here. Yeah, so she also has that understanding. I just didn't want this conversation. I wanted to have this conversation about being practitioners. And as practitioners, we have to feel the pain. And you can look at the resilience of Black people. But I don't want to make this about Black people. I want to make this about our own suffering because we're all suffering. You know, it doesn't matter what your race is. The suffering, believe me, is pretty much shared throughout. We're all, it doesn't even matter. She lives in Canada. They got their own mess up there too. They got to deal with their own suffering and all this, you know, pain that everybody's going through. It doesn't even matter what country. Because we're living in the dark ages and we're not living in the light of the Renaissance. We're living in the confusion and the fear and the worry of the dark ages. But one last thing. There's such a negative connotation around darkness. Black, dark, terrible, it's mean, it's bad. But there is so much possibility of liberation in the dark ages. It's why we have to be in them. It's why the Buddha pointed to suffering as the doorway to awakening. It is not the curse, it's the doorway. So the fact that we are born in a time where the world is in such disarray, and yet we are practitioners based in an energy of rising, we could uproot greed, hatred, and delusion in our lifetime because it's so widespread. But that means we have to be willing to practice in this kind of balanced way to hold it. All right. That's a lot. I know that's a lot. I know. I go to the edge. I can't help it. Sometimes I wake up in the morning and it's like, this is an edge conversation. And I knew it when I saw that poem. I was like, oh, it's going to be an edge conversation. But I think we need it sometimes. I think we need it to regenerate the soul and to have our hearts uplifted in a way that we will not get downtrodden by all the difficulty we see. So for those of you that want to share in a talk, we're going to have about 15 minutes to share with each other. We're going to have 15 minutes, but I think I'm going to put people in groups of two. Dyads, so you can talk fuller and longer. But I'm worried here about Lillian and Nikhil, Sean and Bruce. I don't want to, you guys are going to have to be in groups of three. Okay, so your time is going to be a little bit smaller, but I want you to hear a voice other than the voices that you listen to all the time. All right, so we'll put it in groups of two. We'll have dyads and we can share more. All right, thank you all of those of you that have to leave. We always leave space for people to be able to check out if they need to. It's great. And while they're saying goodbye, I am going to make our groups here. Okay, so I'll open the rooms up. We have, we'll take 15 minutes and then I'll see you back. All right, thank you. So, we only have a few minutes, but if anybody would like to share a couple of things, we can. Actually, I'm hoping that you'll sit with it a little bit, and then at the end of the month, when we have a more fuller discussion, you would have had time to have it everything digested a little better. But let's see if anybody has anything that's come up they want to share. Go ahead, Charlotte.
I'd like to hear more of what you have to say about how we're living in the dark ages. Are you going to do that? Is it the anti-vaxxers? Is it the anti-abortion laws? Is it anti-voting? I don't know. So that's where I had went with that. But I'd like to hear more from you.
Well, I'll talk probably more about that on Monday night. Not this Monday, because we're doing the forgiveness ceremony. But next Monday, we're going to talk a little bit more about how you practice in. We're going to talk more that on the 20th, like we talked to this morning. But history, dark ages are just times when there's a lot of tussle between who we are and what we believe and what's the right way and things are changing and it shouldn't change and all of that is happens. We've had many periods of dark ages of human history. This is just one of them.
Arb. Oh, I'm supposed to raise my hand.
Oh, that's good. I can get Nahil and Nikhil in a minute. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Were they ahead of me? They can go first.
Go ahead.
Okay. We had this talk. It's funny when you asked us as the prompt of living between these two things, because that was the thing that stuck out to me in what you were saying before. And it was a challenge to me. I was trying to figure out where I was and what those things were and what the felt sense of those two sides were. And I think where I got was, you know, the altruistic world is, you know, this, for me, it's where I'm almost too tender. I feel too vulnerable, and touching the really hard stuff, the gray areas, the areas I'm not right, you know, or I don't know, that feels painful. You know, when I'm too much, so that's kind of where I was identifying that world. And the other one, the relative world, is kind of maybe to me more this antagonistic world, you know, where we're embroiled in the fight and there's an us and there's a them. And we identify, I was with Lauren and we both had the same response for living between the two, which is that for me, it's metta, it's loving kindness that allows me to move between. And Lauren mentioned, I don't want to speak for her, but she was talking more generally about the Brahma Viharas. So all four of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm sorry about switching you out of your group and putting you in there with Lauren, but it's sort of like Lauren wanted to have a group, and so I had to find somebody. I figured you wouldn't stress out too much about it. But yeah, the tenderness of the altruistic world means that we need to get, you need to feel into that, because the tenderness is keeping you from really leaning into it. And the agitation and the fight of the relative world is also like you're fighting it. And you got to lean into it. So it's sort of like the metta can help you relax into the fact that there are two different worlds here. And it's okay. It's meant to be that way. I think the more uplifted you are in the idea of practicing with this, the more balanced you are between the two, regardless of how difficult each one is. Let's see. Nikhil, let's see what you have to say.
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to say that I appreciate that we're talking about this topic and kind of approaching from that context that you were mentioning of like kindness and compassion, because I feel like it's something that is almost being pushed back against and kind of the normal discourse that you see in our society and how these issues are so, we view them as being so important, and that, and it's the consequences of being wrong are so high that we almost vilify people that have a differing opinion, as opposed to kind of approaching something with empathy and kindness and compassion, trying to hear what people who might disagree with us have to say. And you know, I read a little while ago about a group that was, they were fighting white supremacy, but it was actually run by past white supremacists. And they're really successful in what they do, because I think they have that kindness and compassion, and they're able to understand where someone might have, why someone might hold those beliefs and what path might have led someone there. And it just seems like, you know, trying to figure out, you know, where we want to be and kind of knowing, realizing the reality of where we are. I think it's hard to see that reality without kind of what you were saying about like having that openness to view it and not being kind of afraid to see it and potentially in certain areas realize where the reality or the altruistic vision that we might have, where it might fall short or where it might, where we realize, oh, like our own perspectives have to change, right? Like having an openness to like our own fallibility or ability to be wrong about something.
That's right. And we won't really know that unless we feel the pain of the tension between our views and whatever we're happen to come across. And learning how to allow tension and discomfort to be a guide to knowing where to go is a difficult thing to learn, but I think that's what we're learning as practitioners. We're learning how to let discomfort be the thing that helps us know when we're off course, rather than letting, I feel great, that means this is the right way to go. I feel good, so it's the right way to go. But actually, we're learning something opposite of that. I feel tension, so I'm on the right path. Let's stay here, wherever that tension is. That's where I want to stay. And that is a different way of moving in a world, especially a world that's so full of tension right now. And all of that tension is, it's part of the potentiality for great awakening. Like the Tibetans believe that the greater, the harder the journey, the bigger the enlightenment at the end of it. So if you want to have big enlightenment, you got to have a hard journey. You're going to have to go through something. If you want to have big enlightenment but have an easy journey, not going to happen. You're going to have an easy enlightenment, just a little blurb. But if you really want to have that great opening, of, which is where I think the humankind is going, to a great opening, then we're going to have to go through some great difficulty to get there.